ऑलरेडी ज्वाइन. सो व्हाइल ही स्टार्ट ही शोज द स्क्रीन आई विल गिव अ स्मॉल इंट्रोडक्शन. प्रोफेसर ब्लूम कैन यू हियर अस?
Yeah. Now, are you going to say embarrassing things about me now? Is that the next item? It's...
Not today.
Okay.
So Professor Ken Bloom is Vilas Kathir Professor and Chair in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Nebraska Lincoln, and he serves as US CMS Operation Deputy Manager during the US Particle Physics Community PUMAS study of 2021-22. He co-led a working group on the societal impact of particle physics, which led to his deeper involvement in issues around particle physics and climate change.
Recording in
He's a
progress.
co-author of a new paper on this topic that will be published in annual reviews of nuclear and particle physics this year. Over to you, sir.
Okay, you ready? I mean, we're a few minutes early, but I should start. Do you want that?
We can wait a couple of minutes.
Up to you, up to you. I mean, probably the people who are coming to hear the talk are probably here, right? So we can
Right.
And you know, not you know, so okay, we'll do it. Leave more time for questions at the end. Okay, let's see. So we'll do the screen share. How's that looking?
Perfect.
Okay, very good. So boy, the Zoom presentation is always not quite the same experience as doing it live, since I'm just talking to my computer screen here. But we'll I have some comments on that too, but we'll do the best we can. Thank you for coming. I certainly appreciate you taking the time to come and hear about this. Of course, this is a presentation I usually give to more general audiences who are not experts in the subject. Probably by the your very presence here, you know a lot already. So I hope I'm not boring you too much with this, but we'll talk a bit about some of the issues I've been involved in looking at, and maybe. If you want to go out and give presentations on this, then maybe this will give you some material and some inspiration and some ideas for how you might go and talk to other audiences about this yourself. So okay, so th this presentation is really based on two papers that we have out there, and I'll tell you a bit more about those. And I mean, I should start by saying that, like, I was doing nothing on this topic, a few years ago, right? Sure, general interest in climate change, and in the usual sort of lefty way that you should feel about things, that we should be trying to do good things for the world. But I wasn't doing much about it. I wasn't particularly knowledgeable about it. I didn't own an electric car. It was just a sort of background thought about things. This started changing when it did. So July 2017 is when I put the date on this, when I ran into my friend and colleague Véronique Boisvert at CERN. And classic CERN of you're going to eat lunch at R1, and look, there's someone else at R1 that you didn't expect to run into. But there was Véronique, right? And we were in graduate school together at Cornell, and we were active in the early career community back when we were early career, which is a long time ago now. We've been to each other's weddings, and we have same age children and stuff like that. But we hadn't had a long conversation in a few years when I just ran into her accidentally. And so we're sitting and talking about things, and probably a lot of you know Veronique already, since she's quite active in this area. And she was talking about what she's working on, and she said, "Well, I'm thinking of changing my research direction." And I said, "Okay, so why are you thinking about that?" She said, "Because I'm worried about what my, when my kids will ask me, why was I working on the LHC when the world was burning up?" So, okay, that was a pretty strong statement. So asked her a bit about that, and she was getting more interested in climate change. She wanted to, teach a course on it and just think about how she could get more involved on this topic. And we finished lunch, we went off and did our own things. I didn't think about this anymore until a year and a half later, when the previous European strategy update process was going on, and she and some colleagues had written a short white paper on sustainability for that round of the strategy update. They were seeking endorsers on this. So I wrote to her and I said, okay, look, this is great. You said you wanted to do something and now you're starting to do something. So that's good. And I see you're looking for endorsers on this, and I'm not in the European community, but can I endorse it anyway? Which I was thinking mostly just to support her, right? And she said, sure. So, okay, I signed my name on the list. And then I didn't think about it for even longer until we get to 2021, when we had the snowmass process going on in the US. And I get an email out of the blue asking, it went to Veronique also asking, could you lead a topical group within snowmass about societal impacts of particle physics, and environmental issues were explicitly, within the charge of that, pointing back to the European strategy update document. And I'm thinking, why did they ask me to work on this, given that I have no history on this? The answer must have been, I endorsed the thing in 2018, right? So the first lesson to learn is, be very careful about what you sign, because it can actually have some impact on what people ask you to do in the future. So I talked with Veronique and I said, okay, this could be fun. We'll learn something and we'll get to work together on a project for the first time in ages. So let's do it. And we did. So that was sort of a year we spent on that with other people too. And that led to this first archive paper, which is the our working paper for the Societal Impacts Group on the carbon impacts of particle physics. So this certainly got some notice. I started getting seminar invitations, and I gave the first ever version of this talk 3 years ago now. We were just out of the pandemic, and this is like my first trip to give a conference talk in several years. And I went around giving this talk. It got some notice, such that in fall 23, we were asked to write a paper for annual reviews of nuclear and particle science, right? Big review journal. And so Veronique and I worked on that for a while, and you can find that out on archive now, and it'll be published in annual reviews officially in September. But you can read the near final draft now on archive. So that's how I got to be here. Okay, so more about the actual topic as we get into this. So first of all, I'm not a climate scientist. This is, so don't ask me any hard questions about how we know things in climate science. This is I'm coming at this as a particle physicist. This is certainly also by no means an exhaustive look at the topic. There's a bit of a focus on future colliders at the energy frontier, because Veronique and I and other people we've worked with are interested in this topic. It's where we do our mainline research work. So there will be some overlap with Katarina's talk from yesterday, but that's okay. So if nothing else, I hope this presentation gets you thinking more about the impacts that we all have on climate change and what we, both as individuals and as society, can do about it. Okay, so I'm not sure if there are any Americans on this at the talk today. So I don't know how much you know about US geography and so on. I live in Nebraska. This is deep in the middle of the country. This is a red state. So there's things you have to say if you live here, right? You gotta remind people that climate change is a real thing. We have these carefully calibrated statements from the International Panel on Climate Change that it's unequivocal that human influences warm the atmosphere, ocean, and land, that there are widespread and rapid changes in the atmosphere, ocean, cryosphere, and biosphere that have occurred, and that global warming of 1.5 to 2 degrees centigrade are going to be ex will be exceeded during the 21st century, within the lifetime of Veronique's kids and mine, unless deep reductions in CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions occur in the coming decades. There's solid evidence for this, and we saw some similar plots in just now in the intro talk. If you can look at the history of global surface temperatures over the past 2,000 years, and there's something very different going on. Starting about 150, 100, what 80 years ago, whatever it is, right? Since the start of the Industrial Revolution, right? There's a clear change in surface temperatures. This is not some cyclical thing. This is not just some phase that we're going to get out of. This looks really different. And if you zoom in on that particular period of time, you can see that in greater detail. And also, you can see this modeling work that has been done, right, to try to simulate the impacts on global surface temperatures just from totally natural sources like solar and volcanic activity. which you could easily point out for reasons for climate change, but also then adding in the impact of human effects in there also. And you can see that the surface temperature changes are much more consistent with something happening due to human interactions than just natural factors alone. At the same time, what's been going on is these increases in concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, right? And you know, for much earlier times, you can look back at the gas you can pull out of Antarctic ice cores to look at what the atmosphere was like, you know, a few hundred years ago. And now we more actively monitor it, and you can see these steady increases, you know, much more greater increases in the second half of the 20th century. And this provides a mechanism for the global warming. And you can really see the effects of this all around the world, right? Through a growth in incidences of hot extremes, in incidents of heavy precipitation, in incidents of agricultural and ecological drought happening all over the world. Although, interestingly, you know, maybe not as much here in the eastern part of the United States, where a lot of our policy decision makers are. I don't know if that's related or not. But you can see these effects all over the world. So if you want to limit the warming, this is going to require significant reductions in CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions. And the IPCC has done these calculations, right? That every 1,000 gigatons of cumulative CO2 emissions leads to roughly a half degree increase in warming. And thus you have to talk about a carbon budget, right? A fixed amount of carbon and CO2 and equivalent that you can emit to keep a lid on the warming. And the IPCC statement is that we have a total budget of 300 gigatons of CO2 equivalent emissions for an 83% chance to limit the warming to less than 1.5 degrees centigrade. And that's the that's the amount by which at which you start to worry about some pretty significant ecological changes. So 300 gigatons, that translates to 1 ton per person per year until the year 2050. So certainly, audiences that don't think about these things much, I tell them, the one number to remember in here is the one, right? You get 1 ton per year per person. And for all the talk, anything you read in the news about climate change, I don't think it emphasizes that number, right? There's not we're physicists, right? We like quantitative things, and you really want a number to hang on to. And the number here is 1 ton per year, is what we all get. If you look at global CO2 emissions per capita, we're pretty far away from one, right? The world average has been pretty steady at 5 tons per person per year. We're off by a factor of five right now. It's very different in different countries. And a piece of good news, I guess, is that the U.S., which used to be the largest per capita emitter, this has slowly come down over the past 25 years, right? So we should be glad for that. At the same time, some very populous countries, India per capita has been steadily rising during that time. India also rising, although more slowly. And those are both countries, with a lot of people, and those are rapidly developing countries that have a great demand for energy. So we clearly have a lot of work to do as a world, right, to bring down carbon emissions. Okay, so what does this have to do with particle physics, given that this is a global problem? Well, when you start to think about it, activities associated with particle physics have the potential for scientists to have a carbon impact well above that of average citizens, right? That if we're supposed to keep to 1 ton per year, but if you start thinking about it, we probably do a lot more. So we have to start paying attention to this. Why? I mean, you could, think of a moral reason for this, that we are responsible for leaving behind a habitable planet for Veronique's kids and my kids and maybe your kids. But if you don't want to think about that and just be practical and think about the impacts on particle physics, our major projects are going to have a significant carbon impact and are going to be scrutinized for it. How can people not ask about this at this point? Is this going to be an element of project reviews, that everyone's going to have to be talking about their carbon impacts? Will we be asked to pay a price for the carbon that we emit? And is that going to have, an impact on the total costs of the projects that we're talking about doing in the long term? So this is why we want to be looking at this. And more broadly, one of the reasons I do particle physics at this point is that because we are a real world leader in international cooperation for common goals. That We are living in such a dangerous time in the world, but that we can pull together a global community that can do something good is really one of our great strengths. And can we do this something similar here in this area? And for all of us, we're doing particle physics because we love particle physics. And how can we do this science that we love sustainably? So let's take a look at a few topics. And actually, no, before that, yeah, another field, right? We're not the only ones thinking about this. I saw this, it was already a few years ago. Like the astronomers are looking at this too. They've done some studies. This is a paper from Nature Astronomy from, I think, 2022, where they tried to, sort of do an estimate of the carbon footprint of astronomical research infrastructure, right? This is like just to build the infrastructure, just to build the telescopes, launch the satellites, stuff like that, and try to figure out what the carbon footprint was. And they worked through it, and they estimated they had a footprint of 36 tons CO2 equivalent per year per astronomer, right? You're allowed, your quota is one, and they're doing 36 just on running the infrastructures before anyone is actually doing any of the research that makes use of those infrastructures, right? And this 20 million ton carbon footprint that they estimated, is sort of similar to that of a mid-sized to smaller European country, right? So pretty serious impact from these research infrastructures. So if you have start seeing numbers like that in other disciplines, what's our number? Could be up there too. Okay, so the major section of this talk here is thinking about future colliders, right? We're very excited about a potential future collider program for the field, but what is the carbon impact of this? And this is the main topic of the paper for annual reviews that we have out now. So big list of potential colliders that are on the menu. A lot of them require a new tunnel, right? If you're talking about building an FCC, an ILC, some of the other Higgs factories out there, or a muon collider, these are all, will require some significant civil construction. We're talking about these different projects to be going on all around the world, different places. You might think about, tunnels are expensive and they're a lot of work. Could we build something in an existing tunnel? In particular, could we reuse the LHC tunnel to build another electron-positron collider or a higher energy hadron collider in there? You probably still need to do some auxiliary construction to reuse that tunnel. And if you look towards the generation after this generation, right, that already talking about colliders that would reuse tunnels yet to be built, right? FCCHH or the another hadron collider that would be a follow-on on China. You could reuse that big tunnel, but you'd still need to do some more civil construction in that. So we took a look at all of these future projects to try to figure out their carbon impacts. And I have to note here that all the projects are evaluated based on their current designs, and there could still be, certainly hope there are some significant improvements in emissions in the future. So this is a just a snapshot of today and should not be taken as something that's written in stone for decades to come. So let's start with the civil construction, right? You need to build a tunnel or pieces, other pieces of things before you can build an accelerator. And it turns out to be a big deal, right? The construction industry actually contributes 10% to the world's total carbon emissions. And that just comes from this chemical process that you need to make cement, right? You're basically burning rock to make cement, and that emits CO2. You're probably burning coal to make the fire, to burn the rock. And a rough estimate is that you're actually creating a ton of CO2 per ton of cement. Remember, you get 1 ton per year, right? And this is a process just hard to decarbonize by its nature. And so one tunnel, one big cement project we thought about at first for the SNOMAS project was FCCEE, right? NHH. This is gonna be a 90-kilometer tunnel. This is a much larger tunnel than we've ever built in particle physics before, and it'd be one of the largest in the world. And not only do you have to build the 90-kilometer tunnel, but there's all sorts of access shafts and bypass tunnels and so on, and the caverns and it's a pretty big construction project. So for the SNOMAS paper, we just tried to do sort of a back of the envelope calculation to figure out the carbon impact of the main tunnel, right? Never mind the access shafts and stuff like that. We looked in the design report, and they had the picture of this annulus, Veronique and I were, we're two middle-aged professors, but we could still like calculate the volume of that annulus and figure out how much concrete was in it. And concrete is 15% cement, and you figure 1 ton of carbon per cement, and we came up with 240 kilotons of CO2 that would be that you'd emit in to make this main tunnel. But also we tried sort of a top-down approach. You can look at, there's studies out there of the carbon impacts of tunnel construction that say is sort of, sort of generate 5 to 10 kilotons of carbon per kilometer of tunnel. Okay, and it's 100 meters tunnel, so this is maybe 500, at least 500 kilotons of carbon. So hey, we're physicists, and we did two different calculations. They agreed to a factor of two. We said, great, we understand the problem well enough. It's a lot of carbon. I don't know. Maybe 5,000 physicists are going to make use of this tunnel, and it's 500, 500,000 tons of CO2, and you get 1 ton of carbon per year, right? So this is a pretty big amount of carbon. It would require 6 million trees to offset that much carbon production. If you want to compare it to a modern construction project, and this is the East Coast U.S. version of the talk, compared to the One World Trade Center in New York City, a relatively new skyscraper in New York, that took, there's about, 200 kilotons of carbon emissions associated with that skyscraper. To build the FCC is the equivalent of, building a few skyscrapers underground, right? That's what we're actually doing in this project. So that's what the back of the envelope thing we did for Snowmass a few years ago. The field has gotten more sophisticated about this by being able to do life cycle analyses, right? And this is very standard for studies of environmental impact. Use a life cycle analysis framework to characterize emissions associated, with the full life of a project, by as the name implies. And this is something like real environmental engineers do, and there's a set of written standards for how you go about doing it. And this should be better than back of the envelope. So, and Katarina mentioned this yesterday, right? That there has been a life cycle analysis done now by this AARUP organization for two possible future colliders, the ILC and CLIC, covering the civil construction for the whole thing, the tunnels, caverns, and access shafts, and that covers the whole thing from material extraction all the way through transport and construction. We looked at that study, and we extracted from there a few factors that we used for estimates of the carbon emissions per kilometer of tunnel length for the ILC, right? And they, you get it's 7.3 for the ILC tunnel and 6.4 kilotons per kilometer for the CLIC tunnel. And that's in pretty good agreement with that, 5 to 10 that we were using for the back of the envelope study. So you have that, and we tried to leverage those factors and other things that were in the AARUP study to try to make estimates for future colliders. This is definitely not as detailed as the AARUP study, right? We use their serious stuff and then made a spreadsheet. Some of the future colliders have done their own attempts at a life cycle analysis, also quoting the AARUP study. We're just quoting their work, but for the other future colliders, we tried to do our own estimates. And so these are the resulting estimates for the carbon emissions in megatons for the different collider options that were out there. So you can look at these. I will say that sort of our original back in the envelope calculations were a decent estimate, right? We came up with basically half a megaton of carbon emissions for the FCC tunnel, and this gets you a factor of two bigger than that. And sure, once you try to include everything besides the main tunnel, you could easily imagine another factor of two. Generally, of course, the emissions for the civil construction scale with the length of the tunnel. No surprise there. And FCC tunnel, the SEPSI tunnel in China, right? Those are the two biggest tunnels, and so that's you get the biggest emissions there. But when you think about the renovations that you might have to make to these tunnels for a future experiment, you're right. To rebuild a different set of caverns that you might need for FCC HH, that's still a pretty substantial addition to the emissions from the original tunnel, right? And such that the more compact muon collider, right, is sort of coming in the same range of what you'd have to do to reconfigure the FCC tunnel for the Hadron collider. Yeah, so these really end up dominating the numbers, as you will see, because we looked at a few other things too, right? We looked at, for instance, the accelerator components, as Veronique likes to call them, the shiny bits that you have to put into the tunnel if you're actually going to run an accelerator. Okay, so what are the shiny bits? If you're building a linear collider, this is dominated by the RF cavities, right? To accelerate the electrons as they go down the line. And these are mostly niobium. So, if you look at something like the ILC, it's going to have 8,000 cavities in it, about 40 kilograms of niobium per cavity. We had an estimate of the carbon intensity of the production of niobium, right? From mining it to refining it and all that. We estimated that there's about 26 kilotons of emissions for those cavities, and that's only about 10% of the impact from the civil construction, so subleading. If you're going to build a circular collider and you got to make the particles go around in the circle, you need a lot of magnets for that. So this is a magnet-dominated machine. Those are mostly iron and aluminum. So we looked up the specs of the FCC EE dipoles. There's 2,900 of them. They're made of iron and aluminum, and you can find the carbon intensity to produce those metals. And you add it all up, and it's about 40 kilotons of emissions for that. And so that's only about 4% of the impact from civil construction. So definitely subleading. So this is sort of the new thing that we did, right? Was to try to look at the impacts of building the accelerator itself. And it turns out that th this is small compared to the civil construction. Once you build the thing, you're going to operate the thing, and then that requires electricity, right, to run this. And so an important feature in here, right, is that we got to make some assumptions about what electricity generation is going to be like on the time scale of when you're going to run these accelerators. And we're working on the assumption that electricity will be significantly decarbonized on that time scale, right? All of these accelerators are at least 10 years away. And, decarbonizing the grid is one of the easier things to do compared to, say, replacing everyone's cars. And so, we needed an estimating scheme for this, and we followed the International Energy Agency's announced pledges scenario, right? This is assuming that nations will meet their current aspirational targets on time. So, if you look at the plot here, and I think Katarina showed some of this yesterday, and I think she was assuming the STEP scenario, which is less optimistic, less aggressive. We're going with the APS, which is more aggressive. This is the dotted lines, and we're doing this on the hypothesis that if you're not following the more aggressive scenario, that the disruptions that could occur from climate change, if you're not decarbonizing that quickly, could be sufficiently large to put particle physics at risk, right? If there's enough other problems going on in the world, maybe we can't afford to do particle physics and won't be running these accelerators at all. So that's why we went with this more aggressive scenario. It's really interesting. You can see that very different states of carbon intensity of electricity production in various advanced economies compared to the developing economies. No surprises there. But that does mean, if you look at the different situations for decarbonization in different parts of the world, that has a real impact on the carbon intensity of accelerator operations. So looking at this, first of all, we only looked at the Higgs factories, right? Because if you're looking at the generation of accelerators beyond that, they're presumably going to be operating in an era of net zero emissions, right? And that won't be a concern. Geography plays a major role, right? US and Europe should have decarbonized electricity by the time of any Higgs factory startup. So it's things like the ILC that's proposed in Japan, which is going more slowly, SEPSI in China, which has a much longer path to decarbonization. That's where you're going to have the most significant emissions from operations. And then, when you try to calculate out the power consumption, across the program, and put that together with the path towards decarbonization, you can calculate what the estimated emissions are. And because you're going to put these accelerators in those particular places, it turns out that the emissions from the operations from electricity turn out to be on the same scale as construction. Interesting numbers there. I don't want to like let everyone off the hook because of, being in a zero emissions era, power consumption will always be a concern, right? Because electricity supplies may be constrained, right? We need to have enough like electrical capacity to run these things. And when everyone is charging their cars every day, a lot more electricity consumption, and you need to make room in there for to run a particle accelerator also. So this is the summary plot from the big study we did for the annual reviews paper, and looking at for these three different phases: the construction, the civil construction piece, the operations piece, and the components, which we only calculated for just two sample accelerators, what you get here. And so this is, I don't know, this is what you got. And this is sort of, we're sort of halfway through the talk here, and sort of, this is the end of a major topic. So maybe I'll stop here just for a moment. So I'll give myself a chance to take a breath, and if there's like a question or two right now, we could take them.
Do we have any questions at this stage?
Okay. And I can't see anyone's faces. I'm not getting any sort of visual feedback on how well this is going, but hope you're enjoying it so far. Okay, you want to keep going? We'll keep going. Okay, so pivot point here in the talk to just talk about other things we do in particle physics, and what their impact is on climate. So let's take a look, at not in the future, but right now, right? And emissions at CERN. And we saw one of these plots in the introductory talk this morning also. But well, okay, you get to see it again. So this is looking at emissions at CERN, and we'll introduce some vocabulary here, right, about scopes that are used for bookkeeping of emissions, right? So you got scope one, which is emissions directly from your organization. These are things you're doing yourself. There's scope two, which is indirect emissions. They're basically other people's emissions that you're making use of. The emissions to that are emitted by the power company for the electricity that you're using falls into scope two. And then scope three is, everything else, upstream and downstream, right? It's your travel to and from work, it's your business trips, it's your food that you're eating at your workplace, the things you're buying. I think this is harder to quantify, but somehow people, there are formulas, people can do it. And so here's, CERN's emissions broken out into the three scopes. You might think, hey, the LHC, it takes a lot of energy. There must be some pretty big scope two emissions because we run the LHC. Yeah, maybe, but in fact, scope one emissions dominate at CERN, right? It's not the electricity that's dominating CERN's emissions. To be sure, there's a reason for this. The electricity is coming from France and Switzerland, which are already, and we'll see this, highly decarbonized electric power generation there. So, so what's happening in scope one? Well, here, CERN breaks it out for us over the course of different years. And what's dominating these emissions? Boy, it's what we're doing in the LHC experiments. It's particle detection, detector cooling, the dark blue and the light blue bars that are dominating the emissions at CERN, right? It's not anything else going on at the site. It's what we're doing with the experiments. And you can see, of course, and it has the expected behavior, right? During long shutdown too, also during the pandemic, right? Emissions are much lower because we're not actually running the detectors, but then they pop right back up during run three once we're doing all this stuff again. So where are these emissions coming from? They're coming from the gases that we're using in these experiments, right? There's this whole long list of chemistry things I don't know enough about: the perfluorocarbons, hydrochlorofluorocarbons, these other fluorine gases that are out there. That all go into the scope one. They're used for a variety of things, especially particle detection and detector cooling. Just to pick out a couple of these, I mean, these are some pretty significant greenhouse gases, right? This C2H2F4, I don't know the name of that, but it has a 1300 times the global warming potential of CO2, and some of these other gases, much greater warming potential. So pretty ugly gases from a climate standpoint. Why am I picking out these three gases in particular? Because they're heavily used in the detectors, right? And a lot of the greenhouse gas emissions from detectors are from, the C2H2F4 in particular, which is used heavily in the RPC systems. So this is, this is a talk we got from Beatrice Mandelli, who's probably, she's in the gas group at CERN, and this is, when during the run-up to Snowmass. This is already a few years old. So while looking at some older things, comparing in particular, the colored bars are emissions during run two compared to emissions during run one. And two features here, you can see that, in Atlas and CMS, in fact, emissions went up as you went from run one to run two, going in the wrong direction. I have to note also, like this is one of the few places that Atlas actually does better than CMS. On the physics, never, but on greenhouse gas emissions, okay, here, Atlas is doing better. To be sure, look, these are complicated systems, right? There's 90 kilometers of gas pipes across 30 systems throughout the LHC experiments to do these gas systems, and the basic challenge here is that the detectors are leaky, right? And if you're talking about a muon system, I mean, the leaks, these are deep inside the detector, right? And you'd have to sort of, take the detectors apart to really go in and fix these things. It's a hard problem. CERN has worked hard on this, right? Some significant progress on developing gas recirculation recuperation systems that are, specialized for each detector. At this point, the gas that goes into the detector is 90% recycled, so we are really working hard to not just vent the gas, but to reuse the gas. You can really do this recuperation process, right, to sort of clean up the exotic gases and make them high quality for reuse in the experiment to maintain performance. Certainly, a concern for the future is that these hydrofluorocarbons are being phased out. And they're not going to be available to future experiments, right? We're going to have to find other gases. And there's R&D in progress on that, but it's not especially promising, right? The eco gases that are out there that could be replacing show worse performance in the detector, stronger aging effects on the detector. So there's a lot of work to do. And if you're looking for a research topic in detectors for the future for yourself, looking at how we can replace gaseous detectors is a good place to be working. Let's see. So once we run the detectors, we take the data, we gotta process the data. Computing is a big part of what we do, and it's a big part of my own personal research. If you look at just sort of worldwide, data centers and computing are contributing 2 to 4% of global greenhouse gas emissions right now, and you only expect this to grow before electricity is decarbonized, right? And I don't know, you start thinking about artificial intelligence, which is a very energy hungry sort of computation. There's going to be a bigger demand for electricity, and right now that's powered a lot by fossil fuels. So, how do you think about this problem before we decarbonize? Well, first you can think about where are we putting the computing facilities and how are they powered? There's a great variation of electricity emissions across countries and even regions within countries. So here's a plot of carbon intensity of electricity generation across time in different countries. I picked out the countries specifically that are hosting tier one sites for the LHC experiments. And hey, maybe we should be trying to do more of our computation in the countries that have less carbon intensive electricity. Here's a plot within the US from the electricitymap.org website. This was a fascinating website, right? I spent too much time looking at this. It purports in real time to show you what the carbon intensity of electricity and for different grids, different regions are. And hey, for CMS, we've got a tier two site in Florida, which has some of the dirtiest electricity generation in the world, right? In the country. Maybe we shouldn't have put that facility there, and we should be looking to put those in other places. Once you've built a computing cluster, you want to maybe be smarter about how we use it, right? And these are, and I work in computing, right? So I think about questions like this, so I'll share them with you, right? Could compute centers expose information on their carbon impact so that experiments can use it in scheduling, right? And try to do some optimization, just not just in how much computing capacity can you get, but what is the carbon cost of that? can reschedule the jobs to run at times when electricity supplies tend to be cheaper or cleaner. And this is, you're going to be, tend to be at the times that have less demands on electrical systems. Can we consider carbon impact as an element of computing performance when we benchmark, right? When we're buying hardware, we're certainly looking at, how many cycles do you get per unit of electricity that you're using? Can we also be looking at, what's the carbon impact of a computer that you're buying before you buy it? And can we invest in optimization of power consumption for the products, the libraries that we're commonly using in the field, right? The simulation packages and so forth that everyone uses. Or at least, can we track progress over release history and see that we're getting somewhere on reducing improving the efficiency of all these computations. If you're looking at the further, the longer term, once you've decarbonized the grid, then you have a different set of considerations. For one thing, you do expect electricity supply to be constrained, as I said, right? Once everyone is charging their cars. So, the energy efficiency of hardware algorithms still a concern and still something you want to work on. And you want to try to use more efficient computing hardware, parallel processing, GPUs, tensor processing units that can be more energy efficient. Then again, we also know that increased efficiency does not necessarily lead to reduced total energy usage. And hey, what's your instinct once once the Monte Carlo goes faster? Hey, let's make some more Monte Carlo, right? And get a get better statistics into your samples. You're not necessarily going to use less of a resource because the resources become more efficient. And then the emissions are not associated with operating your computers, but with making your computers, right? The embodied carbon associated with the manufacturing process. Dell will tell you that one of their servers has 1,300 kilograms of carbon embodied in just one of their servers. You get 1 ton per year, right? Remember that. And that computer has a ton of emitted carbon associated with it. So you want to look at improved manufacturing processes. Can you extend hardware lifetime? How do you go about recycling computers? Things to think about as we move forward. Okay, so that's computing. Okay, I usually introduce this topic differently by, talking about me showing up somewhere to give a talk. But today I can talk about, not going anywhere to give this talk since I'm just sitting here in my office. But here are all the places that I've gone to give this seminar, right? Places I've flown to from Lincoln, Nebraska. I don't know. I could have done it online, all those places, but I had reasons to go, right? Because you get to meet people. I'll also note, like the Snowmass conference, was in Seattle, which is up here. Like, so we took people from all over the U.S. and we all, brought them to one of the most remote places in the country to have that workshop. Maybe we should have had it somewhere more central in the U.S., like, say Lincoln, Nebraska. Why didn't we have it in Lincoln? I mean, I can tell you why we didn't do Snowmass in Lincoln. There's a lot of reasons, but but there's, you can wonder about travel. And particle physicists, like, we're famous for how much travel we do, right? I mean, your colleagues say, oh, particle physicists, they're on planes all the time, because the experiments are in a small number of places in the world. That we have a worldwide system of conferences that we go to. At the moment, air travel is only 2% of global emissions, but it's been going up rapidly, and certainly pre-pandemic, it was rising very rapidly. And this is just a hard thing to decarbonize, right? The energy density of a fossil fuel is very helpful for moving a plane around, and long-haul flights in particular are decarbonized. And you can talk about electric planes, but that plane is basically it's a heavy battery with wings attached to it is an electric plane, right? One future fun feature of petroleum-powered planes, right, is that they get lighter as they fly, right? So takeoff and landing is a very different thing because the mass of your plane is different when you land than when you take off, and that is not the case for the electric plane where you're carrying that battery. Okay, I mean it's like true from an E equals MC squared standpoint, but that's not enough to be a real difference in this. So this is something we did for the annual reviews paper also, right? We took a quick look at what might travel look like for a Higgs factory. A Higgs factory, you could imagine it being at CERN. Maybe there's a collaboration of 5,000 physicists. That might be the right scale for a Higgs factory experiment. Maybe half of them stay on site. The other half are somewhere else. Some are close by, and some are much further away, right? Have to cross an ocean. go from the US to CERN. So, we did a model of this, of, what the carbon emissions were per trip. The long-haul trips are much more carbon intensive. Maybe you take fewer of them because you're coming from further away, but, that still gives, the remote collaborators a much greater emissions per year per collaborator, like 8 tons per year. You only get 1 ton per year. So, if you imagine a travel model like that, then the emissions from travel are about a quarter of that from the civil construction, right? The megaton that you need for the tunnel. But again, subleading, but not small. So, what's the approach you got to take here? Try to reduce long-haul travel while still maintaining equitable experiment participation, right? You want people to have the same impact, to have the same set of experiences as much as possible. For that, you're probably looking at longer residencies, right? You don't want to, fly, maybe you're sending someone to be at CERN for, 2 or 3 years rather than having them, go back home a couple times a year. And maybe we have to look at carbon offsets to try to address the impacts of the travel. Travel. I mean, it's still important, right? It's important to get people in person, and I am very much missing getting to be with you in person and to interact with you in person, right? Because if we were all together for this talk, we would be having conversations afterwards. We would be going out for coffee and stuff like that. That's not going to happen because I'm giving the talk this way. And I think, that from the pandemic, right? We've learned a lot, right, about what can be done remotely and what can't be done remotely. And I think, you've had your pandemic experiences and what didn't work in that. We can certainly look at, greater reliance on regional centers. So that people don't have to fly across an ocean to participate in particle physics, but places they can go closer by, they can have a long-term residency, some capabilities there for remote operations. We do this at Fermilab in the US, that you can do a lot of remote operation of CMS from a control room at Fermilab, as a way to get people together more locally. Improving meeting technology, right? Zoom, it works, but can we, can we really provide the same experience to everyone regardless of location? Can you reproduce the experience of hanging out in the Building 40 atrium, while on Zoom? At the moment, I would say no, right? But it's the sort of thing we want to find a way to get to. Conferences. Oh boy, that's an interesting question, right? Do you have to show up at a conference? What's it for? I mean, it used to be, decades ago, to find out anything, you had to go to a conference, right? To hear the latest developments. Now it's a career development thing, or are we just going there for fun? People have looked at this. It looks like sort of 1 ton per conference participant to stage a conference. You only get 1 ton per year. So we can think about, more accessible venues, virtual attendance conferences like this one. Or do annual conferences need to happen annually? Could you set up a distributed conference that takes place in regional hubs? All things we can think about, and maybe, judicious choices can have an impact. So I don't know. Thinking about going forward, what can we do? I mean, certainly these issues are getting more attention in the particle physics community. Hey, this conference right here happening right now. That's a way that's getting more interest. We're seeing tracks on this now at IChEP that trying to generate interest on this. Starting to see some funding opportunities around this, and we are starting to see future facilities start to pick up. These lifetime analyses to optimize their designs to reduce environmental impact, and Katarina talked a bit about that yesterday. We're getting a bit more interest in the community. We got one sentence in the big Snowmass summary report. 70-page summary report. It got one sentence in there. And in the U.S., right? We had the big P5 report. That's the strategic plan for the U.S. That came out a year and a half ago, and there was, one of the more minor recommendations in there that we should be developing a sustainability strategy for particle physics. Tossed it to HEPAP. I'm on HEPAP right now, and in collaboration with international partners. No one really has responsibility for this, but hopefully we can get something done. What are the practical things that we can do, in terms of R&D? For future colliders, it's the civil construction, right, that needs the most mitigation. What can we do to reduce the lengths of these tunnels, and still achieve the physics goals? And not only do you save carbon, you save money if you can make a shorter tunnel. Can we look at different building materials? Everything is based right now on Portland cement, but there's different variants of cement out there that have lower emissions, but, are they going to give you the structural stability that you need? On the detector R&D side, the biggest issue out there looks like alternatives to the gas-based components. Overall, of course, anything that reduces electricity consumption is a help, even in a decarbonized electricity scheme, because we're expecting limited supply of electricity. In general, though, you want to really set quantitative emissions targets for these projects and specify pathways to meeting them, not just for this to be an abstract qualitative goal, but if you want to get something done, as a physicist, right, you always need numbers, right? And you want to have target numbers and really, really specific strategies. Maybe we got to look at doing negative emissions for these projects, right? If we have to satisfy a net zero policy that's imposed on us by government bodies, how can we do some sort of negative emissions to offset? Well, you could look at nature-based solutions. We took a quick look at these for the paper. Afforestation, right? Growing forests where there weren't some before. Reforestation to rebuild forests. Yeah, it's a lot of work, right? I mean, trees, only peak their peak absorption rates when they're mature, right? A 50-year-old tree is what is going to absorb the most carbon. So presumably we should be, for the FCC, presumably we should be planting the forests already if we want to start to offset that. I hadn't given a whole lot of consideration to this, but yeah, interesting fact. I mean, sure, you can grow trees, but if that tree then lives out its life and decays, then like you've re-emitted the carbon, right? So you have to build the tree and then use the tree, right? Cut down the tree and make it into something, so that you don't re-release the carbon, right? So that's we're gonna need to build many more buildings out of wood, and all sorts of things need to be made from wood to capture the carbon. It takes a lot of trees, right? The megaton that's associated with the FCC scale tunnel. If you want to offset over 10 years, that's going to take 10 million trees, 10 to 30 times the size of Central Park in New York City. It's a lot of trees. Or you could look at technology, right? Carbon capture technology. There's the Climeworks company that's building this plant in Iceland, $600 million to build it, significant amount of electricity to operate it to capture 1 ton of carbon. And if you want to absorb that 1 megaton, you'd have to operate this facility for 28 years. And that's just to absorb the carbon associated with this tunnel for particle physics. You're talking about carbon capture for a world's worth of carbon emissions. That's quite a lot of technology and a lot of these mammoth facilities to be able to do that. So yeah, we got to work on trying to keep from emitting the carbon to begin with. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up. So the summary, right? So human influence climate change is real, and particle physics does have to be considered in that context. And I think we've seen here that a wide range of our activities can have an outsized impact on carbon emissions. And I think something we're seeing now over the past few years, these more realistic estimates of emissions for future accelerator projects that are becoming available, right? Whether it's me and Veronique trying to calculate things, or it's these life cycle analyses that really have some serious engineering consideration behind them. You can get a quantitative impact of what the emissions are. You can see that there are significant challenges in significantly reducing emissions and in reducing net zero, but there's definitely things that we can explore. And what I think we got to push on, right, is getting our funding agencies to view sustainability research for particle physics as normal particle physics research, right? That you can include besides here's the data analyses I want to do, and here is the detector development I want to do, to also say in there, hey, I'm going to work on sustainability research as part of my grant too, and get your funding agency to pay for that. How do I feel about all this? Boy, if you sit here in the US, it's pretty easy to be pessimistic because with our change of government this year, we are definitely going in the wrong direction. And we might be stuck with 4 years of going in the wrong direction at least, right? I'm very worried that my own country, which is one of the bigger carbon emitters, is not going to be helping out on this. On the other hand, You know, as a scientist, as a teacher, I got to be an optimistic person, right? That most recent IPCC report that certainly highlights lots of problems says that it's also not too late to slow the impacts of climate change, but we need to get started now. And I just got to believe that a community that can build and operate some of the world's most complex scientific experiments can also address this challenge. So glad you're here. Glad you took the time to listen to this. Hope you'll get on board. Hope you get your friends on board also, and pursue this. So thank you very much. And also, by the way, I did go and buy an electric car. So, okay, I'll take questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much for such a fantastic talk. We already have a question. I did see a raised hand somewhere. Okay, it went.
Okay, I'm gonna stop sharing here so I can try to see what's going on.
Yep. So, Hannah.
I did see someone else put up their hand before me, but they look like they've taken it down. Okay, I can go ahead and, yeah, please do raise your hand again. So yeah, thank you. Thank you. That was a really interesting talk and overview. And I think, yeah, like a really good overview of all the issues and all of the numbers that we're seeing within the field. I guess my question is, quite early on, you showed the all of the proposed experiments and their potential impacts. And obviously there's quite a bit of big uncertainty of those numbers at the moment.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But there was quite a big difference between, say, the Muon Collider and then the FCCEE and FCCHH. I guess, what's your opinion in, obviously, there's a big discussion ongoing around those. What's your opinion in potentially waiting for the Muon Collider technology to be ready? Because it seems to be a much smaller environmental impact. And, like, how should we weight the environmental impact compared to the progression of science and that kind of thing?
Yeah, boy, that's a tough question. Do you want this? Do you want to look at this slide? Do you want to look at the bar graph? Let's
Yeah, this one works. This was the one I was referring to.
Boy, that's a hard question, right? The various white papers you've read about, opinion of the community, right, has been, we care about these issues, but we don't want to stop the physics. And I think that's the tenor of the community right now. I think that there are, I think, real concerns about the sustainability of particle physics as a field if we don't keep doing particle physics, right? If you wait several decades to run an experiment again, do we like know how to run an experiment? And are we sort of ready to put that into I don't know, Han Solo in the carbon block for a few decades, right? Put that can we put particle physics as we currently practice it into suspended animation for a few decades while we work on these other problems? I understand the inclination, but it sounds impractical. I got plenty of things to do right now. I'm not committed to any future Collider project at some point, but I'm gonna keep working on these things, right? And try to help make them happen. So I don't know. I mean, it's we have our challenges, but these are societal problems too, right? And I'm not, I don't think we can put this all on particle physics and particle physicists, right? And I think, if we need to keep working on a global picture and not we alone are not going to solve the climate change problem. It doesn't take, we have to be concerned. It doesn't take us off the hook. But I'm not, no, I'm, throw me in jail if you want, but I'm not ready to stop particle physics to just because of this.
Yeah, thank you.
We have our next question, Valerie Lang.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So it's a bit less of a question, and rather a bit of a comment. You mentioned a lot the US process, strategy
Yeah.
process, but we
Yeah, I'm
have
in the
the
US. Yeah. Yeah.
European strategy process also ongoing right now.
Yeah.
And just wanted to comment that there are a couple of sustainability statements in that one included. So, I think much more than last round. So maybe that can also give us some hope, and maybe that can also be somewhat a push in that respect from Europe coming to the US, because if something is built at CERN and in Europe, then it has sort of the European regulations on that. And then participating institutes from the US might have to, or might could force, like push for also fulfilling that, because they are participating in a European project in a sense, sort of like something built in Europe under the European regulation. So that might be handled also given the political situation.
No, that's quite possibly true, right? You know, if I had to lay a bet on it, right? I mean, the next collider is most likely to be in Europe, right? That's I think the direction things are going. That you know, d despite our U.S. muon collider dreams, although I mean that's a further off dream. I think you're right, and also. And you're also right that I mean this is just getting more attention, right? I mean this is more people are getting interested in this, and I mean in part through everyone who's watching this right now, and those of us who've been raising the issues. Sure, that's a reason for optimism, right? Just because it's just getting more attention. Okay, so
And the
I
next
guess.
question. Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. So Greg, I guess, is up next.
Hi. You showed a slide of the gas emissions from CERN. Could you go back to that?
Yeah, sure. This one, or yeah, okay.
No, that, I think that's the one.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, the next one, the one you just flashed up briefly now, with that's go back, that one,
This
that's the
one?
one.
Okay.
So if you look at the perfluorocarbons, you see this total of around 69,000 tons of CO2 equivalent. But what you have to put in perspective is that these fluids typically have a GWP of around 6,000 times that of the equivalent mass of CO2. So
You bet.
that only represents a loss of 10 tons of those fluids over the entire LHC campus over a period of a year. And if you wanted to, for example, get some perspective, and you imagined an enormous shopping mall with hundreds of air conditioners on the top of it, not running these fluids, admittedly, because we need these fluids for their radiation resistance, which normal people don't need. But you've got hundreds of air conditioners on a big shopping mall, and the collective losses per year are not going to be that different to CERN for a big shopping mall. You know, you're talking about acres of air conditioning, so we do very well. I mean, we shouldn't be too daunted by the size of this number. Obviously, you should do everything you can to recover gases, particularly the fluorocarbons. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I've been having conversations with fluorocarbon manufacturers, and despite 3M wanting to leave the PFAS market, there are other companies saying, look, the electronics industry can't function for semiconductor manufacture without these fluorocarbons. The substitutes don't work in the same way. The suppression of these fluids completely is really unrealistic. There's the wish to ban them, but I don't think some of these fluids there are just not alternatives to. And the electronics industry is so central to Western economies, it's hard to imagine these things being phased out. We just have to be better. We have to do better husbandry of these fluids, if you like, to not lose them.
Okay, yeah, thanks for the comment. Okay. Oh, another one. Yes. So, Jan. Yeah.
Yes, so hi Ken.
Hi.
Thanks for this talk. To me, the two main points you mentioned that have really a big impact. It's length of a new tunnel, definitely. And then another point that you mentioned, that it's not just about carbon emissions, it's also energy consumption. And when you look at the prospects for our future colliders, from that point of view, they don't look good at all. Like FCC-EE is twice the energy of the LHC, and FCC-HH is a factor three. So it goes exactly in the wrong direction compared to what we're supposed to do. So personally, I don't see a way out beyond not building those facilities, which I agree with you is not really the direction that I want to take for us as a field. But if we are reasonable about energy availability and other usage, like you mentioned, maybe we'll be in a situation where we are just not allowed to run those facilities because they consume too much energy. So do you have ideas of where to go to not be in that position?
No, I mean I can't rule it out. I can't rule it out, right? It's these are going to be societal questions, right? No, I don't have an easy answer. I wish I did.
So
Sorry.
we'll take the last question from Shyasi, if you can time.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for the very nice talk. And yeah, it was very detailed and I really enjoyed it. Yeah, so just following up on the discussions, yes, I also agree that these are more societal issues. So, I think in your last slides, you had also mentioned about other mitigating factors like reforestation and stuff. And I mean, in terms of when we have like put this in action or like propose this, how feasible is it that we also kind of like take into account the negative emissions into the, I don't know, the policy making or something, so that in one way, of course, we try to reduce the emissions, and in other ways, we try to like, you know, do this carbon capture methods and something, just to also, because that also helps in every other like not only this physics experiments, but in every other sectors as well. How feasible would that be? Or should we lobby for it?
I mean, I don't think any of the proposals we've seen for future machines have included anything along these lines, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this would probably I'm just speculating at this point for sure, but I mean, this is I think you'd probably need some government agency saying, "Hey, if you want to do this project, you're going to have to do these other things." I think I if I had to bet, that would this is going to have to come from outside. This is just not going to be top of mind for physicists, right? So who's going to be the funding agency that's going to be courageous enough to ask for this?
Yeah.
All right then. Thank you, Professor Bloom. Any further question can be taken up or can be discussed on the conference Matemos Forum. So let's show the appreciation via clapping reaction. Thank you. I'll hand over the room to Hannah and Vasiliki to go ahead with the panel discussion.